This is the University of Otago.
My name's Peter Joyce. I'm Dean of the University of Otago, Christchurch, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce the first of seven public lectures, all of which will be inaugural professorial lectures over these next seven Wednesdays. For those who have come to these before, we're running them an hour earlier at six rather than seven, and we're interested in feedback as to what is the best time. Tonight's first lecture is deliberately chosen to be on a heart topic because it's also Heart Week, and there are pamphlets out in the foyer from Heart Foundation for those who wish to take those. And some will know there have been events on Monday and last evening and tomorrow evening all around the theme of heart disease. But tonight it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Chris Childs. Now, Chris completed a Master of Science at the University of Canterbury. He did his PhD here and has been on staff since 1989. He was promoted to professor in February 2013, and this is his inaugural professorial address. And it will be on the topic of heart hormones. Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, thank you all for coming. As Peter said, it's Heart Week, and it's great to be able to talk about heart hormones and health and disease and give you a hearty professor's perspective. As Peter said, I am from the Christchurch Heart Institute, which is fully part of the University of Otago Christchurch here, a group of about 40 researchers who study anything and everything about hearts. And so just to give you a synopsis on what I'm going to speak about over the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to give you, not necessarily in this order, but some is mixed and matched, a talk about my journey from the mid-80s onward, a talk about the Christchurch Heart Institute story, which actually started before 1988 when I started with the group, but I've been an integral part of that for the full 25 years I've been working here. I'm going to talk about the problems and the problem that is heart disease and the questions that we have asked about that. And by way of some of the answers, I'm going to talk about the science. Mostly, I hope that I will be showing you simple science that is easy for you to understand. And then in small writing, some will be complex, but those slides will be in passing, so you won't need to read or necessarily understand all of that. But it helps make the picture a little more complete. So my story starts, as Peter said, during the 80s, early 80s, I was at university for 6 years doing two degrees. And by the end of 1986, I consider myself a scientist in training. My second degree, which was a master's, involved 1 year of research, but it's not really real work at that stage. So there I was called a Master of Science. I don't think that meant at all that I had mastered science, but more that I was a toddler just out of nappies, a young boy, a master. What I was introduced to in my time at Lincoln was hormones. At that time, I was interested in the effect of insulin, and lambs, or sheep. And that will become obvious as to why that's relevant for what I'm going to talk about the rest of my career. The context in my time at Lincoln was on the hind limb muscle, or, as you may recognise it, the Sunday roast of lamb. So what we were doing as an agricultural college was, how do we make your leg of lamb more lean and less fat? To give a talk on a hearty professor, though, I need to get rid of the leg of lamb and talk about the heart. So the heart is an amazing organ. It's a muscular pump that just keeps going and going and going until the day we die. But at the same time, during the 80s, when I was learning about sheep and hormones and things. Why is the heart so important? Well, 16 New Zealanders die every day of a heart attack or heart disease. And tomorrow it could be you or someone you love, or indeed me. At the Heart Institute, we save lives every day through the development of improved diagnostic tests, prediction and treatment of serious cardiovascular disease, from the bench, the laboratory, to the bedside, alongside patients, the doctors, and into the community as well. And this really summarises the problem that we study. This data is 14 years old now, but is still quite similar today, even though it's changed slightly. 40% of all people who die in New Zealand die of a cardiovascular disease. 22% of coronary heart disease, 8% of other heart disease, and cerebrovascular, which includes stroke and the like. That's similar. In 1990, it was higher than all cancers put together. Actually, now, those numbers have more or less equalised. But it's a major killer of each and every New Zealander. Well, not every New Zealander, but of a large proportion of New Zealanders. So, during the 1980s, the world was starting to discover that the heart was not just a mechanical pump. And this is work that was revolutionary in the study of our knowledge of hearts. It was done by a South American researcher working in Canada called Diebold. Up here is an electron micrograph, a very blown up picture of the atrium of a heart. This is the nucleus, the control centre of the cell. This is the muscular fibres that make the heart contract. But in here, they are granular tissue. And this looks like other endocrine organs. So it was suspected by Diebold. Actually, this was known for about two or three decades before this, but it was suspected that this may contain hormonal type substances. What Diebold did was he ground up, in a very crude fashion, the atria from some rats, the atrium of the heart from some rats, and he injected it into other rats. And what he saw when he injected the atrial heart tissue into other rats was that there was a fall in blood pressure, there was a rise in hematocrit, which is the percentage of red blood cells in the blood, and there was a dramatic increase in both the urinary flow, the amount of urine produced by the rats, and the urine sodium, amount of salt coming out in the urine. So the heart was now to be considered as an organ that also produced hormones. So like most hormones travel in our blood and can be measured in our blood. So scientists around the world in the 80s, including here in Christchurch, started asking the question, does ANP, this factor that Diebold had found and described in 1981, atrial natriuretic peptide, does it circulate in our blood at measurable levels, and are the plasma levels raised in cardiovascular disorders? So what you need to do is take a blood sample, give it to a very clever-looking biochemist-type scientist and get him to measure it and tell you whether, firstly, he can see whether it's there in the blood and also whether it is raised when the heart is under stress. The short answer to this question is that, yes, ANP, the hormone sourced from the heart, is in the plasma and it is measured at a concentration of 10 picomoles per litre. I thought most of you wouldn't know what 10 picomoles per litre was, so I did some crude calculations. 10 picomoles per litre of ANP that is circulating probably in most of our blood systems at the moment is the equivalent of 30 nanograms per litre or 5 grams and 1.7 times 10 to the 8 litres. To put that in perspective, that's like having a teaspoon of salt in 68 Olympic-sized swimming pools. And that is what our clever scientists have to be able to measure. Is the water in these 68 swimming pools fresh, or does it have a teaspoon of salt spread throughout it? So for that, you need very clever tests. This is one of the slides that you don't need to understand everything, but it's just here for completeness. So I'm not going to read everything, but the way that we measure things like ANP is by radioimmunoassay. It involves putting the known compound into a test tube, putting radioactive labelled compound of the same in, separating that out over hours or days with antibodies, and then drawing a curve like this, which gives you a way by which you can measure very low levels of the hormones in this instance. So, during the mid-80s and ongoing, a world-class Christchurch lab was developing assays for ANP and other vasoactive hormones. So here we have our lookalike to the scientist, Professor Tim Yandel, who is here in the audience. Eric Espiner, who is an endocrinologist who was in charge over all of the lab at the time, and Steve Fisher, who was our head technologist and did a lot of the work on this. So, March 1988 was when I first came on the scene. So Chris Charles, this young-looking chap here, actually the photo taken about 6 months beforehand, was employed as a research technician in the lab. And I was employed to measure AMP in blood samples. My first introduction to what is now known as the Christchurch Heart Institute. I just want to take a wee aside now, because this is not only my story, but this is actually work of the wider group that they have done over the next 10 to 15 years. So actually, for 25 years plus of natriuretic peptide assays measuring this hormone in the blood, Christchurch has led the world. It was later discovered, a few years later, that not only was there ANP, a polypeptide of 28 amino acids, like a small protein, but it had two other related cousins which are produced by our body as well, ANP and BNP. I just want to concentrate a little more on BNP because over the coming years that was what gained a little more traction in both the scientific and the clinical world. So this is just a scheme of how BNP is produced in our bodies. When the gene is first translated into a protein, it comes out as actually 134 different amino acids stuck together. Very quickly, probably after it is produced in the cell, the signal peptide is cleaved off and you end up with pro-BNP, now 108 amino acids. And from that, there's a separation to what is called the amino terminal pro-BNP and what actually circulates in our blood, or one part of what circulates in our blood, at least anyway, the active portion of the peptide, BNP, or brain natriuretic peptide. What our group asked was, are the natriuretic peptides, could they be useful as biomarkers? A biomarker is a protein or other measured in blood, or it could be urine or something, whose concentration reflects the presence or severity of some disease states. And this can be used to diagnose diseases, can be used to look at disease risk stratification across population or individuals, prognosis, how well you will do once you are diagnosed, and also potentially to tailor treatments. How should we treat a particular patient? Very early in the 1990s, it was Eric Espiner, I think, actually, who asked the question from our group, can circulating BNP act as a cardiac biomarker? Mark Davis was a young medical student at the time and did a summer studentship collecting patients from emergency department. He collected samples from 52 patients presenting to emergency department with acute dyspnea or breathlessness. So people would come into emergency who are breathless. At the time, it was difficult immediately for the doctor, emergency doctors to tell, was that person breathless because they had heart disease, or were they breathless because they had some sort of pulmonary lung disease, or a combination of them both, or what? Now, these are a little complex, but I'll take a little time to explain them. This is those 52 patients, or 54 patients. This is their level of plasma BNP that was measured as soon as they got into emergency department. The patients who had primary lung disease had lower levels than these patients who had heart failure. And in the subset of patients who actually had both heart failure and primary lung disease, their BNPs were high, reflecting their heart failure. This was important information that the world also thought was important too, because it was published in one of the two premier medical journals in the world, The Lancet. This plot here is called a receiver operator curve, and basically the further you move towards top left-hand corner of the square, rectangle, the better your test is for detecting heart failure. This was the then current gold standard, left ventricular ejection fraction, or the amount, a measure of the function of the heart, the amount of blood that the heart pumped out with each beat. But here is BNP and ANP actually being more specific and more sensitive for diagnosing those patients who had heart failure. In the discussion of that paper, my colleagues wrote, our finding that plasma BNP is raised in dyspneic or breathless patients with heart failure, but not in acutely breathless patients with pulmonary lung disease, suggests that rapid BNP assays may assist in the diagnosis of patients with acute dyspnea. This was in 1994. Actually, our bright biochemists and clinicians were not satisfied with just looking at BNP. They decided to ask the question, does this portion of the BNP, before we were measuring that, does this portion of the BNP molecule also circulate in plasma? No one to that date had discovered that was indeed circulating in our plasma and could be measured. So this is very complicated. I'm not going to go through everything, but basically this is the radioimmunoassay, which shows that, yes, samples do show that it follows the same shape of that curve. This is N-terminal, the left-hand portion of the molecule being measured in the plasma, and it actually is in ratio with the BNP itself. And here are samples drawn from patients which show that it is indeed both circulating in the blood, and also, because this white column, this is the venous drainage of the heart itself, is higher than the aorta, it shows that it is sourced from the heart as well. And probably more important is the filled-in circles here are the N-terminal pro-BNP. In normals, they have levels like this, and the comparison here is to BNP, the mature form itself. Patients with hypertension or high blood pressure have slightly elevated. This is the individual patients, and this is the mean of the group. But as you look at patients with heart failure, and this really is a group of asymptomatic heart failure patients, and then moderate but increasing severity of symptoms, the levels of N-terminal BNP go up. So there was a real need for cardiologists who were seeing heart failure patients every day in their clinics and in the emergency department to be able to look, have an independent diagnostic and prognostic markers across a spectrum of cardiovascular disease, both for those patients who just have early risk factors early signs of actual changes in the structure and function of the heart, patients with symptoms, and patients with advanced diseases. And over probably 10 to 15 years, many studies across the world actually showed that both BNP and N-terminal BNP is an excellent biomarker across all of these, the full spectrum of patients with heart disease, including our own. This is our own work here, but we did work at various levels across here. So by 2005, measuring BNP as a diagnostic test for heart failure was in all the major guidelines for what cardiologists and doctors should follow to determine whether a patient had heart failure. This is 2005, and the two main American College and American Heart Association guidelines. It was also in the European guidelines. 2005, this was first suggested by our group 11 years before in 1994. So that just shows that Christchurch really did lead the world. This is a teaser. I'm not going to talk about this, but this is Richard Troughton's big part of the work that he did. Richard is giving his inaugural professorial lecture on March the 19th, I think it is, and I'm sure that he will talk about this. But BNP can also be used to guide the treatment of patients with heart failure. I'm going to break my conclusions into a number of different ones just for when we move to the next area. But the Christchurch Institute laboratories have led the world for several decades in developing assays for heart and other vasoactive hormones. And the natriuretic peptides are established as biomarkers across a wide spectrum of cardiac disease and can improve diagnosis, prognosis, management, and outcomes in heart failure. Going to get back on track with my story now, because this is taking us back to March 1988, when I was an assay technician measuring the natriuretic peptides in blood. The young me over here. Actually, in the group at the same time, we had who is now Professor Vicky Cameron, who did sheep studies. Vicky had just completed her PhD, was also expecting her first baby, and was also going to go soon to San Diego to reinvent herself, not as a sheep doctor, but as a DNA and genetic doctor. So knowing that I knew a wee bit at least about sheep and that I was a budding scientist, Tim suggested to Eric, maybe when Vicky goes, Chris could switch to being our sheep scientist rather than our assay technician. So Vicky flew off and I switched over to the other side. This was also the time in July 1988 that I first met Mark Richards. Mark has gone on to become the head director of the Heart Institute. He was a cardiologist working at PMH who was actually doing very similar studies to which I was about to embark on. But he did them in humans. I took the career path of doing animal studies in parallel to those. So over the next 3 or 4 years, I actually started doing my PhD in the group. This was as the title of my PhD, Studies on the Integrative, that is how things work together, and physiological role of the natriuretic peptides, these heart hormones I've been talking about, using instrumented sheep as an experimental model. I've got a picture of Eric there because Eric was my sole supervisor during the course of my PhD. He was my main mentor at that time. And in the early stages of my career, he certainly knocked me into shape and taught me how to be what obviously became a scientist of some note. Otherwise, I wouldn't be standing here before you today. But we all need great mentors, and Eric is second to none in his mentoring skills. So the question that we first asked at that time was, what is the physiological role of ANP? I've cheated. I couldn't find a picture of Mark from the late 80s. This is a picture of him from 2004, I think. from the program of his inaugural professorial lecture. But anyway, the way that we did this was we infused low-dose vehicle-controlled infusions in normal conscious sheep. That was what I did. So we infused the natriuretic peptides into sheep, elevated their levels just by a small amount to have a look at what they did. And in parallel, Mark was doing very similar studies in humans. So we were working together as a team. This is from my first scientific publication. This is the study that I just described. So this is over a 24-hour period of infusion. Here is the, we used to call it A and F then, but here is the A and P. These are the normal levels on the day that the sheep didn't get an infusion. And we increased the levels of AMP circulating in the blood by only 2 to 3-fold. This is well within the range that you could see in any one of us, even if we didn't have heart disease in this room. It increases what is the second messenger within the cells. And these are the types of effects that it had on arterial blood pressure, consistently lowering it while the infusion was going in by 10 to 15 millimetres of mercury for the systolic pressure. That's the high number of the blood pressure when you get your blood pressure taken, and the mean arterial pressure, and also reduced the filling pressure of the heart in the atrium. This is very much like what de Bold saw when he did that crude experiment way back in the early 80s, showing that hematocrit increased. When hematocrit increases, it actually tells us there's more red blood cells in the blood sample that we draw. The reason for that is because it actually reduces the circulating blood volume. Water flows out of the blood vessels and into other parts of the body, so the relative proportion of red blood cells is higher. And here is the urine sodium output. On the black days is the day we gave the AMP, so it increases sodium excretion. So even at very low levels of manipulating the levels of AMP, we saw physiological actions at a number of different sites. So a whole lot of studies from ourselves and sheep and in men, and studies from the other labs in the world, go together to informing this diagram. And this is really what integrative physiology is about understanding. So here's the heart. When the atrium of the heart is stretched or the pressure increases, it releases the natriuretic peptides into the circulation, AMP and BMP. That then acts on quite a number of different organs. Except the adrenal gland to reduce aldosterone, which is a salt-retaining hormone. It acts at the kidney to do lots of things. It increases the filtration of the blood, increases sodium output and urine output, and decreases renin, which is another important part of the salt-retaining aspect of our body. It has direct effects on the blood vessels themselves to directly lower blood pressure and increase permeability. All these things then combine to lower the blood pressure and lower the plasma volume and return things back to normal as they should be again. So one slide sums up probably 10 years of work by many people here at Christchurch and around the world. So my second conclusions are, firstly, that sheep are a good model of human heart health and disease. I haven't shown you any disease states yet, but I will do later. AMP and BNP, these heart hormones, are physiologically relevant hormones that contribute to the day-to-day control of blood pressure and salt and water balance. In fact, when you lie down for 30 minutes and then stand up, your levels of AMP and BNP will change in your blood. The heart will secrete those hormones to account for the differences in blood pressure and where blood is sitting in your body. It's that subtle. But I think also another important conclusion is that our collaborative approach, physiologists, that's people like me, sheep scientists, working in partnership with clinicians like Mark and Eric, and biochemists and assay and laboratory scientists like Tim Yandel makes for a world-class research group with the ability to unravel the role of heart hormones. So that brings us now to the mid-90s. The mid-90s is when I first met Gary Nichols. Gary had actually been instrumental through the early 80s in setting up with Eric and with Mark in the early days the work that we did on natriuretic peptides here. He'd also worked on other things too. Then he went to Hong Kong to become professor of medicine and came back to Christchurch, I think in 94 or 95. When he came back, he found out about this other family of hormones, adrenomegaline, and there are other cousins of adrenomegaline too. And he said, right, let's look at this in humans. We doctors will do that. And you sheep scientists, will you look at it in sheep for us? And so we'll work in partnership and work out what the role of adrenomegaline is. Over the next next years, just in sheep studies, not just me, but Miriam, who you'll see a photo of soon, had 20 publications on adrenomegaline sheep studies. So I'm just going to show you one slide of results here. These are actually much higher levels than we were infusing for the AMP. This is a little bit more like bucket chemistry rather than petite low levels. But nonetheless, when you infuse adrenomegaline, actually at two different doses each for 90 minutes, here is the blood pressure going down, the arterial pressure, the filling pressure of the heart rate of the heart. The heart rate goes up, the cardiac output goes up, the amount of blood that is pumped per minute out of the heart, and the peripheral resistance, the resistance in the blood vessels to the blood flowing through them, goes down. I'm not going to show you lots of slides. I'm just going to show you this. It's in colour now because we're into the 90s rather than the late 80s. But actually, it's very similar to the other one that I showed. Adrenomegaline has effects at the heart, increases cardiac output, heart rate, contractility, etc., has effects in the blood vessels themselves to reduce peripheral resistance and blood pressure at the adrenal gland and the kidney and other areas as well. Then we come into the 2000s, 2002 or thereabouts, was when we got introduced to yet another family of hormones that our body produced, not actually from the heart, but from quite a number of different sources in the body they are produced. This is Miriam, who really, through most, not quite as long as me, but most of my 25 years working here, has been my partner in crime in doing sheep studies. Miriam, Eric first suggested to Miriam, hey, have you seen this paper on urocortin? It was very related to a hormone that was, not quite a hormone, a peptide that was well known since the 50s. This is corticotropin-releasing hormone, which is involved in the stress hormonal stress response in the body. So there are similarities between the urocortin peptides and CRH. There are actually two receptors on the cells that these hormones bind to, and whereas CRH and actually urocortin 1 as well bind to this receptor, urocortin 2 binds to this number 2 receptor. So let's just see now what the urocortins do. This is a busy slide. This is studies that I did in normal sheep, and this is studies that Miriam did in a pacing model of heart failure. If you pace a sheep's heart for 7 days at 225 beats per minute, which is much higher than their resting heart rate, which is similar to ours, about 70 or 80, they exhibit all the signs of a human with severe heart failure. I'm going to concentrate on the heart failure panel because that was much more interesting. Miriam often got to do more interesting work because she was looking at the disease states, which showed bigger effects than we often saw in normal sheep. So here is urocortin 2 in this instance, given at three different doses, 2 hours apart. Big, dramatic effects on increasing cardiac output. falls in mean arterial pressure, peripheral resistance, and big falls in left atrial pressure, which is a key index, the filling pressure of the heart. It's a key index of severity of heart failure and a target for treating heart failure as well. Again, concentrating on the heart failure sheep, because they did show better results in this, it also reduces aspects of what we consider the bad hormones in heart failure. Renin, which is part of the renin-angiotensin system, aldosterone and endothelin 1. And then here is the urine effect on urine. Heart failure is volume and sodium retaining in our body. We have too much water and too much salt, which our kidneys can't excrete. But when you give urocortin 2, you increase the amount of urine coming out of the kidneys and increase the amount of sodium. So again, I'm not going to draw complete comparisons, but another family of hormones which have integrative actions throughout the body on many different organ systems. So conclusions three. The natriuretic peptides are one of several, or probably even many, vasoactive hormones that have integrative actions on the heart, vasculature, renal, and other hormonal systems. And the Christchurch Heart Institute researchers have developed a world-class reputation for elucidating the role of vasoactive hormones in health and disease. Now's my second aside. This is my own work, but it's not about hormones now. So hormones are not the only thing that affect the heart. Most organs in our body are also controlled and affected and regulated by our nervous system. Our nervous system is our brain talking to our organs. We have sort of a yin and yang, two different sets of nerves that travel from our brain to our heart. Under normal resting conditions, the parasympathetic, or the vagus nerve, which comes directly from the brain to the heart, exerts the major effect. And that gives us a slow, rhythmical beating of the heart. If the sympathetic system, this red one, becomes more activated, and the sympathetic nerves fire at the heart, it makes the heart beat both faster and stronger. The cardiac sympathetic nerve activity, measuring that sympathetic nerve activity that is directed directly to the heart, it's of major importance in cardiovascular disease. CSNA, as I will call it, is thought to be involved in the etiology or the cause of left ventricular hypertrophy, large hearts, heart failure, and arrhythmias, the short circuiting of the electrical signal of the heart. Direct recordings of CSNA require an operation to open the chest, and that's not ethical and is never going to be done in humans. And until recently, actually in the mid-90s, because this is an old slide, no long-term recordings of CSNA had been achieved in conscious animals. So 1996 came along, and Dave Jardine, who was then a doctor working in Timaru Hospital, wanting to come back to Christchurch, meets me. And Dave and I, in collaboration with a colleague in Melbourne, Clive May, we developed a novel method for measuring cardiac sympathetic nerve activity in conscious sheep. Here's a budding hearty professor, probably an associate professor at that stage, I think, and a very serious-looking Dave. Dave has many faces, but he often looks like that. This is my only real live shot of a sheep. I didn't want to show anything that might offend or might upset you, so under this green sterile draping is a sheep about to be operated on. No blood yet. So I'm showing how we do this in cartoons. Or diagram. So basically, we instrument the sheep by finding the sympathetic trunk, This is the nerves that are running along, alongside the vertebrae, and finding the nerves that come off them and into the heart, and impaling them with the finest of needles and super gluing them in. And then we have other catheters and arteries and veins so that we can measure other things at the same time. This is a blown up but stripped down shot of the heart. So the lungs have been, well, the chest is open. The lungs have been completely removed, so you can see. The pericardium, the sac that the heart sits in, is not there. And normally all of this is covered in a white membranous type material. But this is all stripped away so you can see. Here is the heart, the ventricles, the atrium, the aorta going down the body, and the aorta going up to the heart, up to the head, sorry. And coming out of this nerve trunk just underneath the spine and the ribs are these very small nerves. When you look at these in reality, they look like a piece of dental floss. And then we impale them, stick our electrodes on so they won't move with ordinary household super glue, and then sew the sheep back up, recover the sheep, and have an ability to measure the nerve firing in the conscious animal. This is an example of what we see. Here is the arterial pressure trace, what you sometimes see on the screen on TV medical programs, and the ECG. This is a 1 minute period. This sheep here has been given nitroprusside, a little like nitroglycerine, the spray that some of you may take when you have an angina attack, which vasodilates our blood vessels and lowers our blood pressure. This is the nerve, occasional spikes being recorded at the beginning. But as we see the blood pressure drop, that you can see that the cardiac sympathetic nerve starts firing more and more. It senses that the blood pressure has dropped, and it says, I need to get that heart kick-started again to increase its blood pressure and increase its heart rate. So at the time, in the mid-90s, late 90s, there was only our own lab and Clive's lab in Melbourne who could do this in conscious animals. What did we do once we knew that we could do this? We decided to look at what cardiac sympathetic nerve activity did during the course of a myocardial infarction or a heart attack. So this is a heart attack where the blood vessel supplying the heart muscle itself, when it happens in we humans, it's because we have a fatty plaque in here which grows and grows and gets blocked off and probably eventually gets blocked by a blood clot in there. Blocks off this area here and kills the muscle that is below that in the arterial tree. We don't feed our sheep on McDonald's for 10 or 20 years, so we have to do this artificially. So what we do is we simply place a snare, a stitch around the coronary artery, and we put a snare around it, exteriorize that out through the chest wall so that later on when the animal is recovered, we can tighten the snare and block off the flow of blood going through the artery. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but this is a sheep that was recorded cardiac sympathetic nerve activity increasing as hours and days went by. This is the graph of it, which shows, compared to sheep that didn't have an infarct, over the first hours, this is 1, 2, and 3 hours, and days out to 7 days, here is an increase in the nerve firing to the heart in response to a myocardial infarction. The world thought they knew that, but it had never been demonstrated experimentally before. Sudden cardiac death post-myocardial infarction is also very important. So up to 50% of people die suddenly, especially after a myocardial infarction, and many of them actually never make it into hospital. And at the time that we were studying this, CSNA recordings, the nerve recordings to the heart, had not been obtained during when sudden cardiac death happened, when the heart went into ventricular fibrillation. Why is it so important? Well, Here is some about 10-year-old data from the US. At that time, there were nearly 1 million people die of cardiovascular disease per year in the US. And of those 1 million, nearly a quarter of them died of sudden cardiac death, of their hearts stopping beating before they even got to hospital. A bigger problem, sudden cardiac death, than lung cancer, breast cancer, and AIDS all put together. So this was a sheep that we had hooked up to our monitors. We gave it a heart attack in between this time and measured it over the next, I think this was 28 minutes later or something like that. What you can see is we had very low level of nerve firing at the start. There was an increase some 5 minutes after the coronary artery was occluded. This is 30 minutes after the occlusion, and you can see there's even more of an increase, especially when the heart started skipping occasional beats. So here is a skipped heartbeat making the blood pressure fall and a corresponding spike in the cardiac sympathetic nerve. But this was fascinating. About 5 or 10 seconds before the heart stopped completely, there was a big increase in the nerve firing and a big spike immediately before, the beat before that happened. And that's just showing that graphically. First time it had ever been demonstrated that the nerves fire immediately before a sudden cardiac death, arrhythmic death. We actually went on and looked at 10 sheep that had sudden cardiac death compared to 10 sheep that had had an infarction but not died. And we looked at their cardiac sympathetic nerve activity. This is just measured four different ways for 13 or 14 minutes beforehand. And you can see the group that died all had an increase in cardiac sympathetic nerve activity. So, conclusions four. The chief physiology researchers are one of a small handful now, a few more than just Melbourne and here, but probably only five or six around the world groups in the world that can measure cardiac sympathetic nerve activity in conscious large animal model. As hypothesized but never before shown directly, CSNA is increased in the hours and days following myocardial infarction, and it is likely that it contributes greatly to lethal arrhythmias and sudden cardiac death. Okay, so I'm going to get back now onto the story of the natriuretic peptides. This is work that we've done just in the past 4 or 5 years, from 2009 on. Work instigated first by our younger biochemist, not Tim Yandel, but Chris Pemberton now, and Siri, who was a PhD student working with Chris. For some unknown reason, Chris asked the question, does the signal peptide actually get out into the blood? For years, the textbooks have said that the signal peptide is only involved in addressing the peptide to show it where it should go within the cell, and then it probably just gets degraded. But Chris asked the question, does it get out of the cell, and is it secreted and circulate in the blood? To this day, I don't know why he asked that question. So that was the question he asked. And not only does it circulate, but could it be a potential biomarker like BMP and the N-terminal BMP part of the molecule are? Again, I'm not going to go in detail, but this is just to show that they could measure it with their assay. Here are levels that give numbers, not zeros. And in this bottom panel here shows that when you look at what comes out of the venous drainage of various organs in the body, that the levels are raised, for example, draining the head, draining the heart, and the femoral vein, etc. This is for the biochemists. I'm not going to show you, but this is actually the gold standard to show that mass spectrometry, to show that what Chris was measuring with his assay was indeed the real stuff. He then proceeded to look at what happens in blood levels of patients who are admitted with a heart attack, who have just arrived at emergency department, and draw samples over the next hours and days after, and see if he could measure the BMP signal peptide and how it compared to the more traditional biomarkers. These are the traditional biomarkers that doctors use each and every day: troponin, creatine kinase, and not used as much, but myoglobin. Here is BMP signal peptide rising over just very early, after half an hour or an hour after the patients first got to emergency department. This is one of those curves that I showed earlier, and you'll remember I said the closer you can get to the top left quadrant of this graph, the better the biomarker is for specificity and sensitivity. And troponin, the one that is usually used, is green, and BMP signal peptide was as good as troponin, but interestingly appeared much earlier, which means the doctors may be able to diagnose earlier. So, is BMP signal peptide just a passive bystander, or does it possess bioactivity? To ask that question, Chris and Siri did do some studies in a rat heart just beating on the bench, not in the whole animal, but they came to me and said, Chris, we should do a study in sheep to see if BMP signal peptide actually improves the heart when you're having a heart attack. Here is graphs from that study. This is hours along here and then turning into days as we go across. The animals were anaesthetised for this because they had to have an operation to get at their heart. They had during this period an infusion into the vein of BMP signal peptide. The coronary arteries were then ligated, blocked off for a 90-minute period, and then actually the snare was released, so the artery was reperfused as well. There was not much difference between the group that didn't receive BMP signal peptide and the group that did, in open circles, BMP signal peptide, in their response of cardiac output, mean arterial pressure and heart rate. But when you looked at the markers of how severe that heart attack was, this is troponin measured over hours and days. The higher your troponin, the more severe your heart attack. In the animals that were treated with BMP signal peptide, the red lines, apart from one rogue blue one, are all lower than the ones that didn't. And here is the amount of troponin. That's my granddaughter blowing raspberries. Amount of troponin when you didn't have BMP signal peptide greatly improved, lowered when this peptide is given. And we actually, because this is an animal model, we can look at the hearts afterwards as well. The animals were actually euthanized after 7 days. This is not fresh heart, but it's a cross-section through a heart that has been, in effect, pickled or preserved in formalin, the way that tissue specimens usually are. But you can see the difference here. This is the heart tissue here that is still good and healthy, if not pickled, but this is the area here that has been killed and is dead and non-functioning, the infarct. When we measured the size of the infarct in the control sheep that didn't receive BMP signal peptide but did have the heart attack, compared to the group that did have BMP signal peptide, it had reduced the size of the damage to the heart as well. So my last conclusion before I move on to some thanks is that BMP signal peptide shows early promise as a potential therapeutic drug in myocardial infarction or heart attack. You know, many times people ask me, have you made any new discoveries this week, or even have you made any new discoveries this year? And I have to answer them and say, well, to me, the world of science is a bit like a huge jigsaw puzzle. This is only a very small jigsaw puzzle of a heart. There's actually millions and millions of pieces to fit into the jigsaw puzzle. And we are working at putting one piece in at a time. So we don't usually make big quantum leaps and discoveries. But I like this quote, which actually came from the European Society of European Congress of Cardiology a few years ago. Basic science is defining new pieces in the puzzle to understand cardiovascular disease as a prerequisite to develop novel therapeutic options. And that's what we're a big part of what we are working about here in the Christchurch Heart Institute. So I'm just going to finish up with some thanks. I should thank our major funding bodies. This is the Health Research Council, a direct government-funded body. For most of the last 25 years, they have funded all or at least a major proportion of my salary. They haven't funded me for 25 years continuous. They fund me 3 years at a time if we put in grants which are good enough and competitive enough to be in the top 10% of those that are put in. The Heart Foundation has not funded my salary, but is over many of the years have funded the salaries of technicians who are invaluable in the work and the money we need to purchase the sheep and to do the assays and to do all the surgeries and the like. So big thanks to the major funding agencies. You know, most people in their scientific careers have one mentor who has been very good to them. I have been fortunate enough, as most of us in the Heart Institute have been, to have three very excellent world-class researchers. And both over the period of my career, all three have mentored me at different times. Mark is still the overall director. He's still a cardiologist. Eric was my first PhD supervisor, continues to work in the group, even though he supposedly retired about 12 years ago. Gary is retired now, but still haunts the Department of Medicine corridor. He's here today, but I saw him in his office, his little cubbyhole, really, yesterday. I'm not sure if he was in today. Mark is not old enough to retire yet, but is mad enough actually to do twice as much work. About 4 years ago, he continued to be our director, and he now works in Singapore as well and has set up a group nearly as large as ours there. So even when he worked here, he worked about 200 or 250% of what most people do, and now he does twice as much. He's an amazing guy. These are the other senior members of the Heart Institute, the leaders of the group. Richard, who I didn't talk much about his work, he's the cardiologist who is on the ground and doing all the hard work at the moment. Well, Mark is swanning off in Singapore, but not really. Vicky, who runs the genetics lab. Tim, who is semi-retired, and Chris over in our assay and biochemistry lab. And Miriam, who I've mentioned, who is my closest colleague, really. We work on in laboratory side by side in the animal lab. We've had offices side by side for 20 plus years, and we work extremely well together as a team. And then, seeing as I am the physiologist in the group, Miriam and I are physiologists in the group, this is the real hardcore over the past 15 years of the physiology team. So, Miriam, you do so much work that you get your picture up there twice. Here's Dave. He's still got sort of a serious look on his face. And two excellent technicians who Gavin just finished up last year, and Rachel, who have both been around for 15 years and done much of the hands-on work for the work that I've described. And so with that, I'd just like to thank you, remind you that it is Heart Week. There is an appeal for the National Heart Foundation. If you think that the National Heart Foundation gives a lot of money to our group, they give money to other groups around the country for research, but do a lot of health education and work as well. So, yes, just remember, it's Heart Week, give generously. We need your money to keep on doing more great work. Thank you.